This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today. A massive tornado sweeps through an Oklahoma suburb. A bomb causes mayhem at the Boston Marathon. A gunman kills children at an elementary school, while another kills worshippers at a Sikh temple. They're all tragedies. For some adherents to the Bible's New Testament, though, they are indications of a world moving in an apocalyptic direction. They point to a variety of images from the New Testament's last book, the Book of Revelation. It's a book that's kind of an outlier from the Bible's other more straightforward messaging, and it's one that author and theologian Elaine Pagels has studied a great deal. Pagels is Harrington Spear Payne Professor of Religion at Princeton University, and her latest book is called Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. She was in Wisconsin earlier this year for an event at the Milwaukee Public Library, and I spoke with her on stage then. She started by talking about how her academic interests were informed by her own faith tradition.
Well, that story starts in California. I was brought up there. My family was Protestant. Except that my father decided to give it all up for Darwin. He decided that Darwin was right and the Bible was a bunch of old folk tales. And so he had no use for it. And I was told that religion wouldn't survive. I mean, when everybody got educated enough, nobody would ever care about religion anymore. And that was the kind of environment that I heard about religion. Although I was always fascinated and loved the music, the poetry, and so much else. And then, when I was about 13, some friends took me to a Billy Graham crusade in San Francisco. And to my parents' horror, I just loved it. The music, this power in the blood of the Lamb, the intensity, it was an extraordinary experience. And I really sort of dove into it, and it opened up many things for me, particularly the power of that kind of religious experience. And I've been asking myself for a long time. I mean, I was in an evangelical group for a year, and those people that I was with read this book with great intensity and great seriousness about the signs of the time. So that's, as you know, one way that many Americans read this book. But I've been asking myself ever since, well, I left that group after about a year for various reasons. And well, they said that my friend who was Jewish was going to hell, and I thought it was a weird thing to say because Jesus was Jewish, but it didn't seem to count. Anyway, but it had nothing to do with what drew me into it, what I loved about it. So I left and did lots of other things. Yes, I wanted to be a dancer. I was not good enough to be that kind of professional dancer. So I kept thinking, but there's something else I'm so curious about. What is it about religion, or is it Christianity, that's so compelling and powerful? And that's what I work on.
But along those lines, I mean, you make your living to a large degree studying words that were written, in this case, 2,000 years ago. And I mean, this seems to dovetail nicely with what you just said. What gets you excited about doing this work today and analyzing words that people have been analyzing for two millennia?
Well, people still read these. I mean, the biblical words wouldn't work at all if they weren't so powerful and strange. But also, you know, I went to graduate school thinking I could find out what Jesus really said in some sort of simple way in the hills of Galilee. And then I found out, you know, everything we know about him was written at least a generation later. And it's not so simple. But also, my professors had file cabinets full of Gospels I'd never heard of. The Gospel of Thomas, which I was very struck by that, claims to be the secret teachings of Jesus. And I find it very compelling and very moving, and many other texts. And it's enormously complicated, the picture. And now I realize, Pitch, that there are many other revelation texts. I gave a little sample here of hors d'oeuvres of various other revelation texts. But there was an outpouring of them. There wasn't just one. So I was curious about why this one is in the New Testament and the others not.
Well, and that's such an interesting part of this story, because it was really, they were on the fence. This was not a slam dunk, to use an unfortunate sports metaphor. Why was it Athanasius, why was he successful in including this revelation at the end of the canon and essentially closing the door on anything else that came afterwards?
It's a really good question, and it's not an easy question to answer because, you know, there were Christian movement was very vital and alive for 300 years before there was a canon at all. And people did read various books and heard preaching about the Gospel of Mark and the Gospel of Matthew and so forth, and the Gospel of Thomas. But we didn't have a collection that was a standard collection. And only after the emperor became a Christian, which was a shock to everyone practically, Constantine in the year 312, he had one of his bishops whom he trusted in Palestine, he said, go make 50 copies of the scriptures. And the bishop had to figure out which ones. So there were some books that pretty much everybody read, the Gospels of the New Testament, the letters of Paul. But he made two lists. He said, well, these are the recognized books, and these are the illegitimate books. The only book that's on both lists is the book of Revelation. Because it was so disputed. It's the only book that was intensely debated. Some people said it's irrational, it's crazy, it's not a revelation, it's written by a heretic. And other people said, no, it's written by a follower of Jesus. So there's a huge argument about this particular book.
There are such disturbing images, and yet one of the conclusions to your book is that hope is a key component of the message that we can take from it. Why do you see hope as such an important aspect of what comes out of this, despite it all?
You know, it's part of that other question about how is religion still so compelling today? And I thought the book of Revelation is an interesting test case because I don't see any ideas in it. There are just these images, and they're the kind of images of the forces of good against the forces of evil, and they're the kind of images you see even in children's literature or movies like Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, forces of good, the forces of evil about to take over the world and they have to be fought and so forth. And I think the depth of the power of this book is not about ideas or do you believe in this or that, but it's about hope and it's about fear. It's about what we're afraid of and what we hope for.
One of the most interesting other lessons that we can take from this book, from your book, that is that people have used the book of Revelation basically since it was written to support their belief that the bad things they see going on around them represent the end times. Why do you think the end has been the go-to explanation for people for so long? Why do we have to attach the bad things that are going on around us to this one set of images that we see at the end of the Bible?
Well, that's a good question. It seems to me that, you know, we live in a world of chaotic and often terrible things happening, and people always have, especially when there's war, and there's almost always been war. And so the sense that, is there any meaning out of this chaos and destruction and slaughter and suffering? And this book, like the book of Daniel, claims, yes, there is a meaning. If you get up to heaven and you see it from God's point of view, as John says he was allowed to get glimpses that way, then you see that it's intelligible and that it's going somewhere. And where it's going is not toward total catastrophe. It's going toward a finale which will be glorious, and the world will be renewed.
I imagine it's a dicey proposition to try to read the motivation of someone who wrote 2,000 years ago. But would you imagine the graphic imagery that makes up Revelation was in part so graphic in order to capture the attention of John's contemporary readers?
Well, I think that's how he actually saw the forces of the Roman Empire and the forces of his own people in that time. But also, you know, He's a Jew writing in an empire where Jesus of Nazareth had been crucified for sedition against Rome, and his followers like Peter and Paul had also been, well, Paul was beheaded and Peter was crucified. I mean, it was very dangerous to oppose the Roman Empire. And so he wrote in oblique language that Jews would understand because it's the language of the prophets. because they spoke about the foreign armies of Babylonia and Egypt as monsters, and the foreign capitals of the city as whores. And so they would understand that he was talking about Rome and the emperors and very concrete issues, but in a very vivid, dreamlike way that you couldn't pin it down.
But at the same time, there's no point in being subtle.
It wasn't subtle, but what it does allow you to do is to hope that justice will prevail in the world.
I wonder, do you think should it surprise anyone that the kind of fiery rhetoric of Revelation made the cut and ended up in the canon, whereas the more ponderous material, the other books of Revelation that you write about in your book, that ask kind of, that leave things more open-ended, they ended up not in the canon. I mean, it seems like the stuff that was kind of definitive would be more likely to survive the years the way it did.
Well, I think the people who loved this book were people who lived in persecution. They were getting arrested. They were seeing their friends tortured and killed. And they wanted a hope that, although the government was invincible, I mean, you couldn't imagine a military response to Rome. You couldn't. I mean, they tried, but couldn't. So they wanted a promise in the book. But also, I think this book presents a way to interpret conflict that really puts whoever's reading it on the right side. I mean, that's why it was important to me to recognize that it's been read on both sides. I mean, I mentioned the war in Iraq, where it was read by people in this country. It was also read by radical Muslims exactly the same way, in reverse. And I think that's kind of dangerous to have a book that can be read that way. I'm wondering about if we go on reading it that way in the 21st and 22nd centuries when we can really destroy the world, it's very questionable. So this book, it also talks about who goes into a terrible punishment of fire. And it's very unspecific. John has this vague language. He'll say, oh, well, it's the dogs, the filthy, the evildoers, the sexually deviant, right? And you think, well, who is that? Could be anybody you don't like, really. But it's very different from what you get, say, in the Gospels, where Jesus, according to Matthew, tells a story of who goes into the kingdom of God and who doesn't. The sheep and the goats, that parable, in which he talks about the people invited into the kingdom. It's not that. It's not about what you believe, and it's not about hate speech like the book of Revelation. It's the people who show compassion on those indeed, or people who don't. That's the only question. But that's very different, and that's very specific. It can't be played on both sides.
There's another fascinating aspect to this, and that is when you get into how the book evolved and started bringing in the earliest version of the separation between church and state, if you will. And I thought that it was perhaps an underrated element of the development of Christianity in, I guess, the 4th and 5th century.
That's a really important point that you raised, because, you know, in 2,000 years ago, nobody, whether they were Jewish or Spanish or African or Egyptian or... nobody in the Roman Empire thought you could separate religion and politics, because they were inseparably connected, both for the Romans and for all peoples that they conquered, which are all of those people. And this was a dissident group of Jews who refused to honor the gods of the empire. And of course, they were intensely persecuted for that purpose, because they were dangerous. They were setting a precedent, but they did set a precedent. I mean, the beginning of the separation of what we call church and state, but religion and politics, starts, I think, with Jews and also then with the followers of Jesus. And it becomes, fortunately, I think, for all of us, part of our traditions. And it seems kind of normal now for many Americans, but for many people in so many parts of the world, it's not even there as a concept. Or hardly.
What to you is still the big question out there, either about the revelations that are in the New Testament or these other revelations that were recorded but have only more recently really begun to be dissected?
Yes, the other books of Revelation are not about the end of the world, and they're not about the Day of Judgment. They're really more like accounts of spiritual breakthrough, like the Revelation of Zostrianus. I just included the Revelation of Ezra because it's very much like the book of Revelation. But the others are about how God speaks in everyone, and they're very different. And that kind of understanding of what the Christian message was completely buried by the 4th century. And I think it's significant. I think it's a part of this tradition that we might consider engaging.
Elaine Pagels, thank you so much.
Elaine Pagels' latest book is called Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. She's the Harrington Spear Payne Professor of Religion at Princeton University. Our conversation was recorded on stage at the Milwaukee Public Library's Centennial Hall earlier this year. The Rotary Club of Milwaukee looks back at its first century and looks forward as it works to stay relevant. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on WUWM.